Hello, friends. Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another edition of the Journal Podcast. If this is your first time here, you just hit play. You're here with me. I got to tell you, sign up for the newsletter, thejournal.email. It is what I call a newsletter for the curious, packed with all kinds of weird stuff, productivity hacks, new apps, products that I love. I guarantee you there's be something in each newsletter for everyone. So it's got a 70% open rate. And the only reason I tell you that is because I'm pretty proud of it. I mean, it's a once a month newsletter. So I put a lot of time and effort into finding the weird, most interesting articles around the web and distilling those down into like five or six things that you should check out. So sign up at thejournal.email. Today's guest, Ryan Carson. Ryan and I go way back to the Web 2.0 days where I used to speak at his conferences. And he used to throw a series, a whole different series of conferences. The one that I would always give talks at was the Future of Web Apps. These were massive. They were talking like 4,000 plus people attending these all over the world. He would have them in Florida and he would have them in London. He eventually took this business, grew it, sold it off, and now is the founder and CEO of Treehouse, which is just a great place to learn how to code. And he has some really kind of cool interactive coding challenges, and you can learn all the most modern languages that are out there. I'm also an investor in that company because I really love him as a founder and entrepreneur, and we get into that during this episode. But we also talk about some really kind of cool things around how to set your managers up to succeed, and also how to manage the development process. So if you're building new features, when you decide to kill them off, when you decide to keep them. Ryan is just a deep thinker on so many different levels, and you'll see that in this interview here. So without further ado, Mr. Ryan Carson. So Ryan, thanks for joining me.
No problem. It's always fun to chat.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk about, one, our kind of crazy long history, and then your path through technology and as a builder.
Sounds fun.
When did you first get into computers?
So I remember almost the moment. I was in high school, and I was in the hallway, and I had this math teacher who at the time I thought was super dorky. You know, she was this woman that loved calculus and wasn't very stylish. And she said, "Hey, you know, there's this class that I teach. It's an elective, and it's called programming. And I think you might like it." And
why did she think that about you? Was it like the way you were dressed or something?
She's like, you
look like a dork, why don't you?
I think I was one of the kids that actually paid attention in calculus or something. I don't know why.
Okay.
I don't know why she singled me out. Now I think about it, it's a bit weird, but she was nice. And so basically, I said, "I'll try it." And she said, "You know, you teach the computer, you tell the computer what to do." And I just thought, that sounds crazy, like some sort of superpower. And we learned Pascal, and I'd never heard of that. And it was amazing. And so that was the very beginning of my journey. And, you know, now I'm going to, you know, turn 40 this year, and I am now running a school that teaches coding. So I have a lot to thank Miss Bruce for, that's for sure.
Came full circle.
Absolutely.
So when we first met, you were throwing conferences at the time.
Yes.
And for people that don't know, the Future of Web Apps was probably, I would say without a doubt, the most influential and kind of biggest tech conference back during Web 2.0.
Gosh, yeah. Yeah, back in the day. It's funny, you could really kind of know everybody on the internet in a way back then.
Yeah.
You know?
It is weird. Like, everyone knew each other. It was just like a small group of people.
Yeah. And I remember, I think we met for the first time at Future Web App San Francisco, mm-hmm. and you walked on the stage, and, you know, I was the MC, and I remember kind of pulling you aside and saying, "Yeah, tell me about you." And you're like, "Yeah, I studied computer science." And I think we figured out we were basically almost exactly the same age. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, whoa, this is kind of a weird parallel life, you know. All right, you know, everybody welcome Kevin Rose. And then you went on to speak, and it was kind of fun. We just ended up friends after that.
Yeah. So what led you to get into conferences? Like, what was your, actually one, it might be one step back from there, but what was your first kind of experience as an entrepreneur?
So basically I got a computer science degree in college, because it was really the only thing you could study that had anything to do with the internet. I don't know if you felt like that when you went to UNLV, I think, right?
Yeah, there was nothing else to to really study.
Right. And so I thought, oh, I guess I'll do that. And so got that degree. And then I felt like I had lived in Colorado my whole life and I didn't know what I didn't know. And so I thought, I'm just going to move to a foreign country and really push my my personal limits of comfort and worldview. I used to be a pretty strong Christian back in the day, and or religious, I would say, and moved to England and got a job as a developer. You know, straight up, I went to a recruiter and said, I don't know how to find jobs in England. Will you find me a coding job? And he did. And basically, you know, set about writing code for about 4 years from 2000 to 2004, mostly working for web design companies. And I, probably like a lot of entrepreneurs out there, I just remember kind of doing the mental math for how much my boss was making and for how little work he was doing. And I just thought, this is not a good deal. You know, he seems like he's not doing any work. It doesn't look that hard. You know, how hard can this be? You know, I'm going to build a piece of software and I'm going to, you know, try to make it work. And this was in 2004. And I don't know if you remember, but Jason Fried and David Heinemeier Hansson and Basecamp were and 37 Signals were really becoming, you know, hot thing.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And we all were sort of looking at them and going, whoa, you know, they basically turned themselves from a client services company into a product company. And I feel like they really launched the SaaS revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and they were always very public, you know, about talking about it and how they did it. And so I thought, you know, if they can figure this out, you know, build a simple product, bootstrap it and charge monthly for it, maybe I can too. And so I built a really simple web app for sending large files. Because, you know, back in 2004.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, you just I remember this now.
And you couldn't even send a file that was bigger than 2 megs. It was insane.
What was the name of that product?
It was called DropSend.
DropSend, yes.
And it, funnily enough, it actually was called Dropbox. And we launched it. And then right afterwards, the Dropbox launched. And I just thought, oh, we're never going to win this U.S., you know, trademark battle. So let's just change the name. And so I basically built it, you know, as a simple PHP web app. And this was before the cloud was even a thought in someone's mind, right? So we had to...
And this is no funding. This is you just like, okay, I have the skills to code. I'm just going to go and build something.
Yeah, let's just literally try to figure out. In fact, not even really bootstrapping. I mean, this is literally, I was a developer in my attic. And I worked, you know, at the nights and the weekends to try to build this thing and bought a shared server on, you know, something like Dreamhost or something. And,
right.
And then...
You're on the server with like 10 other people running websites.
Sometimes it just like big files.
Yeah, it like crawls along.
Not good. But, you know, I guess looking back, I had the one thing that you need as an entrepreneur, which is basically naive optimism. You know, hey, how hard can this be? You know, and what's the worst that can happen? And so literally had to figure out how to build, you know, a server that could, you know, you could upload large files to. And then once I did it, it's like, well, how do I sell this thing?
Talk to me about the process of, you know, you were coding, and I've always considered you kind of a creative mind and a very like in touch with good design. So where did you get the designer to help you out with this? Did you do everything kind of soup to nuts here, or
That's
how did
a good
that
question? So I do care about design a lot, even though I myself am not a designer. And I think we're similar in that sense. And it was something innate in me. You know, I just thought good design means good product. So, you know, it's just like when you go to a nice venue, the design matters, right? It really reflects the quality of it. So I did care about design. And interestingly enough, when I was in London, before I started my first company, a buddy and I, also named Ryan, interestingly enough, Ryan Shelton, we decided to create a meetup. And the idea was very simple. Hey, let's just get we called them web designers, but really it kind of encompassed everyone who is, you know, coding or designing. You know, let's get web designers together and have beer and talk about our work and show our work and, you know, network and have fun. And this is before kids or dating or anything. So I had infinite free time. And so we met up and we did it, and we called it By Designers for Designers. And the nickname was Creative Fight Club, because, you know, anybody could run one of these. And Ryan Shelton was really the design half of this. You know, I was the entrepreneurial developer, and he was the one with, you know, amazing design sense and good user experience sense. And so he and I became just a dynamic duo.
Mm-hmm. You know, would you consider him a co-founder on that product?
Yes, in a way. You know, he
it wasn't obvious his idea, but he was there from the get-go.
Vital. I mean, you know, it's interesting because neither of us back then were really savvy around things like equity or funding, or it was really like, I don't know, I have this idea, and you know, if you're too busy to work on it, can I just pay you to do it? And you know, I don't know, it'll work out. So Ryan did all of the design for what became DropSend, you know, for a straight up client fee. You know, he's a good friend of mine, and I said, I can scrape together this amount of money. You know, you want to do it? And like everything, you look back and it was messy and confusing, but it got the job done. Mm-hmm. And we booted it up and put it out there. And you know, what's funny is, and everyone listening to this should know that a lot of things that we all do as entrepreneurs fail, and we don't talk about it because it's kind of embarrassing. But the first iteration of this product, it was called Flight Deck before it was DropSend, and it totally failed. I way overpriced it. I didn't know how to market it. All of it was wrong, and it slowly died. And this goes all the way back to your original question. Okay, where did this event stuff come from? And what I realized as Flight Deck was dying a slow death is that, you know, what I care about is encouraging people, empowering people, making the world a little better. That's really what motivates me. And I love technology. So why don't we combine all these things and try to teach people something, you know, technology or coding. And like a lot of good ideas, I stole the original idea again from Basecamp. They did a workshop called, I think, How We Built Basecamp. And it was a one-day workshop. And they said, you know, it's like $400. We'll just tell you everything we know. And I thought, you know what? Because the internet is so small, and I made so many friends through this By Designers for Designers meetup, I could literally ask some of the smartest people in the internet to speak, and we would charge a fee, and let's do a workshop on how to build a website. And so I wound down Flight Deck and launched our first workshop, and it was called How to Build Enterprise PHP Web Apps.
Nice. Just rolls off the tongue.
It does. It was a sexy workshop.
Yeah, I bet.
But you know what? It sold out. And this is like, this is before social media, right? I mean, you couldn't do any marketing except for emailing your friends and posting on websites. And it sold out, and it was fun. You know, people at the end of the day were smiling and you know, saying, thank you. That was so fun. I learned so much. And I thought, whoa, you know, I just got paid to do something that was fun and people loved it. Let's do more of that. Mm-hmm. And did more. So we did another workshop, you know, and then another workshop, and then thought, well, let's not just do them in London. Let's do one in Chicago. And again, the networking piece that I built back when I did the meetup By Designers for Designers ended up paying off handsomely because I already knew people and they respected me because I had put in, you know, sweat equity into building a community for no pay, that when I came back and said, hey, would you teach a workshop? They literally said, yeah, of course I would. I love BD40. You know, I love By Designers for Designers. Hmm. And so I didn't realize it. Oh, the network. And I would even fast forward that to say, well, it's fascinating to look how we got funding for Treehouse. And it was because of the strong relationship I had built with you, not expecting any kind of payment or dividend or outcome from that. It was just, hey, we're building a real relationship here. We actually like each other. And then when I showed you the beginning of Treehouse as a business, you know, I remember we were sitting in a cafe in Las Vegas, and you said, I like this business. You know, have you ever thought about raising money? And, you know, I was like, no, and I'm against that. And then you're like, I don't know, I might invest, you know. And then fast forward, you know, a year, you know, you said, hey, listen, man, you know, I'll help you put together an angel round. It's going to work out great. And it did. And it goes to show that, you know, putting in the sweat and the blood to build the network and not expecting the payback is just something that ends up rewarding you in crazy ways.
Let's talk about the network, because I think that's fascinating, because a lot of people, you know, would-be entrepreneurs, when you chat with them or they ask you questions about getting started, they just don't know how they're going to market their product. Mm-hmm. They don't know how they're going to get their thing off the ground, and they don't, you know, that's a big hurdle for a lot of people. Yeah. So when you were launching, you know, let's just say any of these last three different products that you talked about or different projects that you built, how did you put together that initial group of people and get attention on these things? Yeah,
that is a very good question. The first business, which I failed at, you know, Flight Deck, which then became DropSend, I didn't do that. You know, I basically had built a B2B product and didn't even know that. And so I was, you know, trying to do sales versus marketing and basically failing. And then, you look back at your life and you think, I didn't even know I was failing. And you learned. And then, what's interesting is, okay, let's launch an in-person training business. How do you market that? Well, word of mouth, right? I've worked really hard to build up some relationships, and I'm just going to start telling people about it and hoping that they see the value, trying to give them something in return. And this goes back to, I remember my mom made me read a book that has changed my life, and it's called How to Win Friends and Influence People. Mm-hmm. And it's by Dale Carnegie. You know, it's an old classic. And the reason why it changed my life is because it really helped me understand that I need to think first about what are the other folks getting out of this? How can I add value for them before I ask for value back? Mm-hmm. And so it was always about that. Okay, gosh, what's in it for them? And my dad would drill me on this. Ryan, what's in it for them? And so I had that mentality from the beginning. Okay, if I'm going to ask a speaker to come and speak, you know, their time is very valuable. Everyone wants them to speak. What's in it for them? So, you know, I think, okay, they're going to want some nice things, like a nice flight, you know, a nice hotel room. That's all, you know, great. But what's really in it for them? Well, maybe they have a book that they're promoting. Maybe they have a web app they're promoting. You know, maybe I can help them do that through the event. Mm-hmm. Okay, that kind of works. And then knowing that these folks have big networks and that they would tell everybody that was following them or cared about them, hey, I'm speaking at this show. And then that would help me do marketing. And so it was very hand-to-hand combat at the beginning.
Yeah.
You know, it was literally just, gosh, you know, how do we sell 2 more seats or 10 more seats?
But you grew this thing to, gosh, I remember going to one of your conferences in London that was, I mean, there must have been,
they got, what, huge,
4,000 people there or something like that?
Yeah, they got huge. And this is the terrible truth behind all this, is that it takes time. You know, we are just run over by stories of Slack and Facebook and Twitter and, you know, how they're these rocket ship businesses that just took off. And we believe the lie, like, oh, a good business just grows. You know, it's just magical. It's amazing. But the reality that I've seen is every business that I've worked on is basically 5, you know, plus years of work. And you start literally, you know, being excited that one person signed up. Oh, and then day 2, it's like 3 people signed up. And it's this like brutal hustle at first. And you just can't go from 0 to, you know, viral success. I just don't think it's real.
How do you gauge success then in the short term? I mean, I'm curious, like, let's say, for Treehouse, for example, you launch a new feature and it's a new feature that, I don't know, just is a new way to teach someone how to code. What do you look at or what do you look for so that you know you're not just putting, good effort after bad, just continuing to invest in something that's not going to work out?
Yes. And so we now do something at Treehouse, which I've adopted personally, which is pretty straightforward. There's a book called Four Disciplines of Execution, or 4DX. And the concept is pretty simple. So you basically say, okay, we need this big thing to happen. We need to get to, $1 million in revenue, or say even 1,000 or 1,000 users. Now that it is impossible to make happen daily. You basically can't really affect that number consistently daily. So, but what you can affect, and so that's called your lag scoreboard. This is the big thing we do need to do. We got to get 1,000 users mm-hmm. by this date. Okay. So my theory is the way I can do that is by doing 10 of these things per day. And as long as I do 10 of those things per day, it should affect the lag scoreboard. And so what you do is you basically place bets. You say, okay, I believe this feature or this marketing campaign or this piece of content is going to drive, 25 signups, but I don't know until I get it out there. So the lead scoreboard, which is the one that should affect the lag scoreboard, is I did my 10 things today. I did my 10 things again today and do it again. And you basically hit this lead scoreboard daily. And then weekly you measure, is this lead scoreboard, which shows that I'm winning by doing, these 10 things I said I would do, is it actually affecting the lag scoreboard? And so it's a way of keeping you from being paralyzed and saying, oh my God, like I don't know how to get 1,000 users. Where do right. I start?
It sounds like you set kind of an overarching goal and then define little things that will roll up into achieving that overarching goal. Is that yes. a great way to?
Yeah, it is. Basically, but they're still bets because you don't know if they're going to affect
right.
it. It's basically your gut instinct, like, okay, if I post 4 times on Instagram per day, and I, make it compelling and I have a certain amount of engagement, the belief is, I'll be able to drive X amount of signups, from that.
And then do you continue to refine that longer list of things that yes. roll up to the lag? So if yep. like posting to Instagram a few times a day is not working, you can cut it and then gotcha.
Exactly. And that's the key is that you're iterating and experimenting very quickly.
And this is what you do internally?
It is. And I do it even in my personal life.
How do you track all of this? Is there an add-on for Slack or just good old spreadsheets, huh?
Yeah. It's one of those things like literally it's so basic. You can actually delay and procrastinate actually doing the work by trying to instrument all of it. I talked to this amazing CEO coach called Marshall Goldsmith, and he's actually one of the leading CEO coaches in the world. And he said, I do something that's almost embarrassing to talk about. And I was like, what's that, Marshall? And he said, I pay somebody to call me once a day and they ask me the same question every day.
That is a little odd. I can see why it's embarrassing.
It's a little weird. But he was like, listen, I know
what
that.
What did you like for lunch? Like, what's up?
Did you take
what
a shower?
What are you wearing? Yeah, exactly.
No, it was very simple. It was like, it was his lead measures, those things he said, I've got to do these things every day in order to have success. And he didn't share what they were, but it'd be things like posting on his blog or, tweeting 5 times, or it's those lead measures. It's the doing, it's the boring shit basically that you have to do over and over and over every day to see the result. And by someone asking him, it basically was embarrassing if he kept saying no every day. So I think there's something there, mm-hmm. And one thing I've realized recently, and I think we talked about this in the coffee shop when we were hanging out the other day, is that because I was religious when I was growing up, I believed in almost like a manifest destiny, that if I'm working on something that truly matters, and I believe Treehouse truly matters, we're giving people practical trade skills so that they can get a job, so they can change their life. I believe that matters, like on some sort of, you know, spiritual level. I believe that the universe would owed me success, that, you know, as long as I, you know, kind of showed up, that it would happen. And I just realized, I think over the past couple of years, the only thing that's going to make it happen is brutally boring, daily grinding work. Mm-hmm. And the only way to keep up, you know, boring, grinding work, and it's not all boring. I mean, I love my job, but there's certainly boring parts of it, is that I have a deep why that I believe in that drives me to that.
Yeah. Let's talk about that. Cause I noticed on your Instagram feed, you talk about your why quite a bit.
A lot.
Yeah. So, well, first of all, tell everyone your Instagram, because I think you got a lot of great inspiration on there and stuff.
Thanks, man.
What's your account on there?
My username is Ryan Carson, nice and easy. I just connected the dots that at some point that understanding my why, the deep, deep reason that I started Treehouse was the key.
Well, let's tell people the elevator pitch on Treehouse as it exists today. Like, what exactly does it do? And in full disclosure, I obviously did invest many years ago, but there's a reason, because I thought it was awesome.
I appreciate
and,
that.
So tell people a little bit about it.
So basically, I got that computer science degree that we talked about, and then I got the job, and it started gnawing on me that the computer science degree was just totally disconnected from the job. And I thought, weird, you know, I don't use any of my degree in my day-to-day work. So what was that about? And I was really privileged and lucky to have my parents pay for my degree, but I could have gone, you know, $50,000 to $100,000 in debt for that. And it started to eat at me. And eventually I thought, you know what, there's gotta be a better way. Let's launch an online school that teaches coding, because, you know, we can iterate the content very fast. We can teach quickly. We can make it affordable. And then we started working on that. And what I realized is that coding, you know, making apps, technology is a trade skill, and that you don't need to go to college for this. I'm not anti-college at all. I'm just pro-person. And really, Treehouse is the trade school of the future. You know, the trade we teach is coding. We teach you how to do it, and then we help you get a job, and we do it for 2% of the cost of a college degree, all online.
So I'm curious. I love to, even though this is like, I mentioned before, I'm an investor. I want to play devil's advocate and be like anti-investor.
Do it.
Just because I feel I don't want people to think this is a commercial, because it's not.
Totally.
We're friends, but I wanted to have you on to talk about a whole slew of different stuff. But on the Treehouse front, like why not just go on the free coding? Because there's a lot of free different coding sites out there now.
There's a ton.
Has that been serious competition for you guys? And like, how do you handle that? And how do you set yourself apart from all the free stuff?
There has. And I think the theme will be useful to anyone listening to the show, regardless of whether you care about Treehouse or not, is that from the very beginning, I believed in charging for the product. I felt strongly that by asking people to pay, it signals very important things. It signals intent. It signals quality. It allows us to invest. You know, if you're paying us up front, then we can immediately take that cash flow and we can reinvest it into the product. And so from day one, we charged $25 a month. And it was scary. And gosh, you know, the other thing I want people to hear me say is that I don't know the right answer. You know, I don't know if this strategy is going to win. And everything that we do as entrepreneurs is a bet, right? But deep down, I think, gosh, you know what? Good schools cost money, and they should be really affordable, but I believe that by asking people to pay, they're going to be more committed, see a higher value. But it's been brutal. You know, it's been a hand-to-hand combat, you know, with our competitors. They've won on some things. We've won on other things. But, you know, 7 years later, we're still doing this. And I think that's evidence that, you know, building a business, you know, that you ask people to pay for the product, you scale with cash flow, you know, deep down, like that's actually what we're all trying to do here.
Yeah.
And so,
yeah, I've been struggling with this myself on a couple of different products I've been working on. One, I launched that fasting app, you know, that I was telling you about, and I decided to give it away for free, 100% for free. And it's funny. It's interesting in that, one of the things that actually my wife is big into this as well, on the whole psychology side of things, you know, she has this cooking course that she charges $99 for.
Right.
And I was just like, hey, why don't you just give it away for free? You know, like blah, blah, blah. And we've given away like, you know, free little test accounts to like friends and other people that, you know, are just like want, they're like, hey, you know, hit me up. And you're like, hey, why don't you just take a free account? Here you go, blah, blah, this or that.
Right.
And it's like, you notice that, you know, people don't have the same level of commitment to something unless they pay for it. You know, and I've heard that in other businesses as well. And so, you know, I was wondering, I'm looking at our daily active users on the fasting app, and, you know, we've had over 500,000 fasts and things like that. But I'm curious,
wow.
I've seen a few other things where retention goes up if people believe, if they're investing their own money.
Yep. And it does make sense. You're basically asking them to do the mental arithmetic before they sign up. You know, is this actually something I want to invest my time in and my money?
Right.
And I think that's a good thing. You know, yes, you have to put pressure on you, but.
Yeah, I think on the meditation side, eventually I'm going to figure out the pricing model that works, because like you said, you take those dollars and you roll it right back into additional content. Like for me, I'm going to be going out and licensing different speakers like around meditation and just like wisdom and spirituality and things like that in general. And those cost, you know, thousands of dollars per little audio track.
Right.
And so I'm thinking if you charge something, you can then roll it back in and create an even better experience for everyone.
Right.
It's just trying to find that balance, you know, of how much is too little or too much.
It is. And, you know, the Silicon Valley culture, and you've been right inside it, and I've always been outside of it. You know, I started my business in the UK, crazily, because I married a wonderful woman that was British, and then I moved to Portland instead of Silicon Valley. So I've always been outside of the growth at all cost mentality. And I'm not saying that's what you believe, but you know, you've been there physically and seen all that from the inside. Mm-hmm. And what it was really interesting to see what happened in early 2016, because basically the money train stopped.
Yeah.
And, you know, everybody was raising money on growth numbers. And then my theory is it started when LinkedIn's stock, you know, dropped massively in the public markets, and it caused this whiplash, you know, all the way through to the private markets, where people said, whoa, we have to cross the chasm here between, you know, growth to profitability. Otherwise, there isn't an actual business here. Mm-hmm. And the public markets aren't going to recognize this valuation. And so everybody, including Treehouse, that was out raising money, you know, took that punch in the face. And everyone, we realized, oh, okay, you know, we really do need to build a profitable business here. And that put a ton of businesses, out of business. It caused a bunch of M&A to happen. And it's just interesting to see that, you know, when the money is really on the table, and investors are being realistic, what they're saying is you got to build a real business. Mm-hmm. And as founders and entrepreneurs, we should be saying that to ourselves. But it's hard, you know, it's hard not to chase growth at all costs.
No, it's true, especially when your competitors are raising a ton of money and they're spilling, you know, millions of dollars into ads and to just chase growth.
Right.
It's hard not to want to do the same.
Right. And this is where having a long-term marathon mentality is the only way to survive.
100% agree.
Man.
It's funny. I've also changed to your way of thinking here in the last couple of years. Like, when I think about the rolling out the meditation app, you know, there's obviously some massive players now in this space, like whether it's Headspace or Calm or others. And like, for me, I just want to build a really high quality product that changes people's lives that we can get to break even at in terms of just, you know, paying the software engineers and that, and just let this be something that is a part of your life for the next 10, 15, 20 years.
Right,
there's nothing wrong with it. That's awesome. No,
that is the point. I mean, that's actually what we're supposed to be doing here. And this is why I said it's so confusing, because you look at Facebook and Slack and any high growth company and you get confused about what you're doing.
Right.
And the reality is, you know, if you have a why that matters, if you're building a business that you truly believe the world needs, then you can have a long-term perspective on it and actually build a business. You know, of course, yes, you want to maximize growth and yes, you want to maximize cash flow and yes, of course. But the why has to come first, and then the long-term mentality has to come first. And
how do you think people find their why?
Boy, I get asked that a lot, actually, since I started to talk about my why.
And, like, I don't know. I have my own. Go find your own.
No, but it's a very good question, because I think it is a deeply human question. It is literally, you know, what people, when they're at their most vulnerable, talk about and go to, because they realize, you know, I wake up every day and I need a purpose. Why am I literally on this planet? And so it goes back to, you know, a primal important reason. So it's a good question. The terrible part is that there doesn't seem to be a straightforward way of finding your why. And the reason why I say that is because, you know, my why was originally about God. You know, I was a Christian, I was religious, and it was like, okay, I've been put on earth because I was created, and, you know, and my why is making sure everybody knows how to find salvation. Like, that's really important. And then when I transitioned out of that, you know, I went through a deep sense of confusion, like, whoa, okay, if that isn't my why, what is it?
And yeah, that's a heavy thing. It's a brutal thing. You and I both were raised very religious.
Yeah, it's heavy.
It's a really heavy thing to wrap your head around.
It is, and you know, and like you, I'm not anti-religious now. I respect a ton of religious people. I think there's beauty in all of it. But you know, personally, I probably transitioned to more of kind of an agnostic. And so, because I didn't think, okay, my job is to now tell people about salvation, you know, what do I get up for every day? And I realized, you know what? Even if there isn't an eternity after this, I believe there's something sacred and important about human life, that everyone's life matters. And I don't know why, I just feel it deeply. And so it's like, okay, I also love technology. I just think it's really cool.
That's interesting to hear you say that, because that I totally believe you in that. Not that I wouldn't believe you, but right. But I remember watching you from the outside, and we weren't talking much here like a couple of years ago. I mean, we'd say hi every once in a while, but it wasn't like we were seeing each other. And you know, I remember seeing your posts on Instagram, like all the Black Lives Matter stuff.
Yeah,
because you were wearing all the t-shirts and stuff like that. I'm like, man, he's going hardcore. I mean, that's there's one thing to believe. I think, like, you know, all of our friends and us, we'd all believe that, obviously. Right. It's like, right. But to go and represent like you did, I thought was really impressive.
Thanks, man. I it's just something deep down, you know, so I truly believe, okay, humans are equal, all of us, all right? We all deserve a chance. Like, it's not fair that, you know, I was born into this amazing white privileged background and I'm male. Like, I just won the lottery of life, right? Mm-hmm. And I was born in America, you know, and I was born to parents who, you know, didn't get divorced. And like, I mean, it's just, I'm in like the 10th of 1% of luckiness as far as setting me up for happiness. And it's not fair that other people pay prices that are not their fault. And so it's like, okay, how do we give people a chance? And so I believe that we're in this amazing point at human history where, because software is eating everything, it's going to create a massive amount of jobs. And because of that—
Well-paying jobs,
right,
too. Like,
yeah. They're well-paying, but because they're actually trade skills, they're not a skill that you need a computer science degree for, you can actually acquire those skills for a tremendously affordable price. So we actually have the chance to change millions of people's lives for real. And it's not bullshit. You know, it's not a marketing campaign. It's something unique that happens to be real right now in human history. And I was lucky to literally stumble into that. I was born in 1977. You know, that meant I was raised in a place where there was enough money for computers. I had a teacher say, you should try coding. I was able to afford college, and then I stumbled into being a developer, and then I realized, holy cow, this opportunity is something that maybe I could actually build something that would truly change the world. Like, not because I'm some genius entrepreneur or because I have, you know, beast-like capabilities. It's all about being in the right spot at the right time and noticing an opportunity. And so it all flipped back to that.
You know, what's funny is I disagree. I think you have beast-like capabilities. I want to talk about that too. I want to touch on that for a second because I think that you have a drive unlike anyone I've ever seen. It's kind of insane in that. No, but like, dude, so we were grabbing coffee like 4 days ago and you were like, I wanted to learn how to climb a rope. And so, you know, I get up at 4 a.m. and I put a headlamp on like to like see because it's dark outside. Your kids and your wife are sleeping inside. You hung a rope on your tree, and then for like multiple days in a row, you're learning how to climb a rope at 4 a.m.
This is all true.
What are you doing?
Something's wrong with me.
No, but where does this come from? Like, where does this sense to like, I see this in really successful people. And honestly, it's one of the reasons I really wanted to back you as a founder.
Thanks, man.
Is because I see this just insane drive. And it's funny, you mentioned a few of the first startups that you had and how like, oh, this one failed, blah, blah, blah. But you just moved on to the next one. It was like, oh, no big deal. Right. Next one. Here we go. You know, it's like, where does that come from?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I think about it a lot because I have two sons, as you know. They're 9 and 6. And I'm constantly thinking about how do I instill in them this capability so that they can be happy, right? Because I'm very happy. And I've sort of settled onto one theme, and I owe just my life to my parents for this. They consistently said to me, I believe you can do whatever you want to do. And as stupid and cheesy as that sounds, having an adult say those things to me and mean it when I was impressionable, I believe gave me this foundation of safety. You know, mm-hmm. I'm able to fail a lot because I can fall back to a safe place and say, okay, you know, yeah, what is the worst that can happen? I'm not going to die. And so a little bit comes from that. But that wouldn't be enough.
That's not enough to get me up at 4 a.m.
Exactly.
I mean, that'll get me working on the next startup, but I'm not getting out of bed.
Totally. So I think the actual thing that matters is that deep why, that crazy deep why. And so it's like, why am I climbing a rope? That's got nothing to do with teaching code.
Right.
But the theme is, okay, I am turning 40, and what will keep me from succeeding with Treehouse is getting weak, getting old, and I won't be able to perform at a high level. And so really my workouts, you know, I'm training for a Spartan super. It's literally about pushing myself physically so that I can perform better on this deep why. And so it kind of flows from that. This is why it's frustrating to say, I wish that you could apply a formula to find your why, but I didn't even really understand mine until I was 32 years old. And so all this wandering around and in the dark and trying things and having them some fail, some succeed, was this wandering path that the only guiding principle was that I believe that human life had value at a deep level and that I love technology. Mm-hmm. And so I would encourage anyone listening to go back to these themes in your life, and whether it's cool or whether it's, you know, interesting or whether it's profitable, whether people think you're dumb or cool, doesn't matter. Go back to this place where you feel deeply about something and just kind of start iterating on that somehow. Mm-hmm. because that's the way I did it. I could only speak from experience, right? Like, I guess I found this why, because I loved people and I believe they matter. And then I think technology is exciting. And then I, you know, and stumbled around for, you know, literally from when I graduated college to when I was 32. And even when I started, it's so funny. I remember one of our investors is Chamath from Social Capital. And you introduced me to him. You're like, you got to meet this guy. He could be a great investor. Got on the phone with him. And I didn't even understand how deep that why was and how Treehouse could be a part of that until he said to me, Ryan, don't you get it? You know, you are empowering people for the next generation to be able to be middle class and afford their life and succeed. Like, you are literally changing humanity. And I was like, oh my God, you're right. I didn't even get that. So I think I'm just trying to encourage everybody listening to say, you don't even have to, it doesn't even have to be clear to you. If you just start working on something that you're passionate about, I believe somehow it'll connect the dots, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, for me, I've been trying to figure this out as well. You know, I think we all are in terms of what that kind of deep, everlasting why is. And I'm sure that why can change over time.
Yeah, and I said this to you in the coffee shop. I think you have some really interesting themes that run through your life. You know, and I had trouble verbalizing what they were, but I can see them from the outside. I think anyone could probably ask someone that loves them and cares about them, hey, yeah, what are these things that you think are themes in my life?
Yeah.
Because sometimes you can't even really see them, you know, yourself.
That's true. Yeah, it is good to get an outside perspective on that, especially someone that knows you well. Mm. You know, one of the things that for me, I think about is just like, you know, if money weren't a desire, so you're not chasing the almighty dollar, like what would you be working on?
Right.
So, you know, what would that thing be, that base thing that you would be working on?
That's a good question.
Even if you had $1 billion in the bank or whatever it may be, you know?
Exactly.
And I just keep coming back to, I think the reason I do audio podcasts like this and the video and the foundation series and things like that is, like you, I like to go out and hopefully help inspire other people and get them excited about the opportunities that are out there.
Yes.
And let them know, you know, the big thing for me is like, I've seen this so many times where people will come up to you and they expect you to have all the answers.
Right.
Because you've like done it or sold a company or worked at Google or whatever it may be.
Right.
They're like, oh, I mean, you've got it figured out. Like, help me. I'm like, no, I don't have it figured out either. Like, I'm just trying to like, you know, we're all figuring this out in real time.
Right. And that's the secret, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the secret. And once you realize that, you're just like, oh my gosh, like I'm hoping that other people, once they realize that we're all just human, are like, oh God, well, I'll go try something. I could do that too. You know, I can learn how to code, whatever it may be.
Yes.
So, you know, one of the things I wanted to touch on before we wrap this up, you know, I've always really enjoyed chatting with you about your crazy ideas. You're always into something like really nuts. Like I've been taking notes as we've been chatting, like, you know, obviously I got to go back and reread How to Win Friends and Influence People. And I also want to read Four Disciplines of Execution. Yep. So I've been writing this stuff down. Another thing that you tried, which I think is just batshit crazy, is this Holacracy stuff.
Oh man.
And I know it was a can of worms for you.
It was.
And so, but I, you know, I think it's worth chatting about because it's crazy. And it speaks to how you are not afraid of anything and you'll try anything.
Yeah, let's
and,
do it.
And I love it. But yeah, just like give me
painful.
Give me the 3-minute, 5-minute version of this. I'm curious.
You bet. So basically, you know, Treehouse was hitting kind of puberty as a company. You know, I think we were at about 50 people.
This is what, four years ago?
Yeah, it was 2013.
Okay.
And so I didn't know why, you know, okay, wait, why are people, you know, saying bad things about managers? And, What really
were these your managers, or were they people, your employees were like, I do not like your manager, right, or my manager.
You start hearing, you know, things through the grapevine, like so-and-so said this, and you're like, what? You know,
you're that size where all of a sudden not everyone is on the same page. That's a hard transition for companies to make, by the way, like 20 plus people starts to happen.
Yes. And we were hitting that big time. And unfortunately, because I had never been trained as a manager myself, I didn't know what was wrong. And it turns out in hindsight, the problem is very simple. Oh, we didn't train our managers how to be good at managing. Duh. People don't know how to be good managers unless you teach them. It's not an innate human skill. And so I knee-jerked and thought, well, let's just remove the managers, right?
This isn't something people normally say. So someone presented a framework to you, correct?
Sort of. So I just, it was kind of based off of, you know, kind of basic gut instinct. Okay, managers, you know, if people are smart and people are well-informed and they work hard, why do they need managers? I literally didn't understand. Don't they kind of get in the way and don't they add all sorts of cruft? And so I did some research and I was like, okay, let's figure out if this is crazy or not. So I did research and found out that Valve, you know, the game company was supposedly flat. You know, I found that Gore Associates, which apparently had like 9,000 employees, was flat.
So when you say flat, you mean just no hierarchy. Everyone is on the same level. So everything from an executive assistant to the CEO have the same power.
Correct. Yeah, they can propose projects. They can start projects. They can do really whatever. And so I started to, I found an HBS study, you know, Harvard Business School, and supposedly it was working. And so we really put a lot of thought into it, like trying to make this system work. We built some software so that people could essentially say, I want to propose a project. Here's the idea. Here's how to measure it. You know, here's how to know if it's successful. Here are the types of people I need on the project. I need a designer, a developer, you know, and a marketer. And then they would hit propose. And then once a day, everyone in the company would receive an email digest of all the proposed projects. And you could click into them. And then if you wanted to join them, then you would join one of those spots. So say you were a developer and there was an open developer spot, you would fill it. And then as soon as all the spots were filled, the proposer could hit begin project.
And crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy. And, you know, in theory, I think it sounds amazing, right? Empower people to truly do what they think is best, you know, get totally out of their way. And I believe if humans were perfect, it would work. But unfortunately, we are not, I think we've sort of evolved to not be able to work like that. You know, we're sort of pack animals and we really start to look for leaders and not everybody wants to lead. And really, I made the mistake of believing everybody is essentially an entrepreneur. And the reality is a lot of people aren't. They don't want to do that. They would much rather fit into a bigger vision, you know, be a part of a team instead of constantly trying to be an entrepreneur and basically be the CEO. And we cranked on it for, I think it was a year and a half. And sadly, it just degraded over time. You know, you would start to see some of the same unfortunate, you know, political situations developing where it turns out only certain types of people were proposing projects, you know, and those projects were getting kind of funded, if you will, because they were popular, you know. And It just kind of broke down. And so, and it was tough because, you know, the media loved this. Like I got interviewed so many times about this. And I just had to kind of, you know, eat my own shit and basically say, gosh, you know, this was an experiment and it just didn't work. And that's okay. If I was to go back in time, I would slap myself and say, don't do it. Not because our people are wonderful. I'm thankful for them and they put in hard work and it's not their fault. You know, it's my fault for not really training them as a manager and scaling.
How do you train folks as a manager?
What's your process?
It's free, and I would highly recommend it. It's called Manager Tools. It's a podcast. It's almost like car talk radio for management, and it's awesome. So if you just Google Manager Tools, it's a free podcast. There is a specific...
Is it ongoing or a set number of episodes?
It's so there's something called the Trinity, which is the three core elements of being a manager. That's out there and it's set. You just, it's a playlist basically. So if you listen to the Manager Tools Trinity, I think it's called, it's just out there. And then you can also pay them if you want ongoing training. And, but honestly, just the basics in management is way more than, you know, most people are ever getting anyway. And it's awesome. So I'd highly recommend. And now, you know, we transition into a normal company with great management, I think, and, you know, a healthy culture, and we're just kind of cranking.
That's awesome.
Yeah. A lot of pain to get there, but here we are.
So tell me about before we wrap up, or I guess we're wrapping up now. Tell me just about the latest stuff that you've been up to. Like, what's the product offering look like now? I know you launched Tech Degrees, right?
Yeah. So basically, you know, as I explained, my goal is to get someone all the way from zero to job ready and then actually help them get a job as a developer. And so we've constantly been evolving. And the latest product that we have, I think, that really does that, is called the Tech Degree. And it is only $199 a month, and it takes about 6 to 12 months. So you're looking at, you know, $1,200 to $2,400 to go from zero to job ready and then actually get a job. And that is going wonderfully well. It's basically an online boot camp without, you know, the huge costs and the 3-month, you know, chunk out of your time.
So I haven't had a chance to play with the product yet, but is it, do you do like mentoring as well? Or I thought I heard something about mentoring from a buddy of mine that was going to help you guys.
Yeah, basically the idea is we take our core curriculum, you know, which we're really good at. We do great video content, plus, you know, coding challenges and workspaces and all this interactive online stuff. And then we supplement it with required projects that you build. And then those projects are graded. And then we attach a Slack channel so that you can talk to all your peers and get support and encouragement and you know, unblock yourself. And then at the end, we have a final proctored exam, which really ensures that, you know, you have the skill set. And then all throughout that, we have created curriculum to help you understand how to go find the job, right? Because it's, if you don't have a computer science degree, it's not straightforward. You know, you have to know where to look for the jobs. You have to know how to apply for them. You have to know how to, you know, survive a technical interview. You have to know all these extra things. So yeah, we've wrapped it up into a product, and I really think something like that is the future of education.
Yeah, it's awesome. I'm a big fan. I jump in there just to see what you guys have rolled out. You know, when you have new courses that come out, and I don't know if you see my profile activity, but I always take like the first few of any like hot new thing. Cause I'm curious. I kind of want to get an overview of what's going on, you know?
Right.
And as a former developer back in the day, coding in, you know, much different languages that have no longer exist, more or less. I remember when you mentioned Pascal at the beginning, I was like, I remember those days.
Exactly.
But yeah, so awesome product. Where can people follow you one more time on Instagram? Cause I know you put a lot of great stuff up there.
Thanks, man. I'm just Ryan Carson, RyanCarson. And I'm also on Twitter, same name. So I'd love to connect with y'all.
Sweet. And let's get together and do some more podcasting together. This would be fun.
Would love to, man. Thanks.
I know
so
we
much
can do some more kind of variety of stuff. I think it'd be fun. We talked about doing a show for those that are listening. Kind of a little variety show would be fun to cover all things tech.
Sounds good. Well, thanks for letting me be on the show. It was a lot of fun.
All right. Thanks, brother. Talk to you soon. Thanks so much for listening. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Also want to remind you once again, if you haven't signed up for the newsletter, www.thejournal.email, once a month newsletter. Check it out. I know you're going to enjoy it.